Well, welcome, everybody. I want to welcome you to another episode of Passports, Please. The power of place, the places that change us, and why it matters. And we've had wonderful conversations over the last 6 months. And as always, Rodney, as our listeners can already tell, we are well into another one with our very special guest, Corey Pollard. And I am your co-host, Chick Morgan, along with my brilliant co-host,
Rodney Bersiel.
Rodney Bersiel, the photographer in chief. So we're going to continue to just jump right into this. And Rodney, I've asked you two and Corey, let's kick it off with a little bit of history, a little bit of context about how we got him on our podcast and how it is that you know him and about some of the stories that we're going to be telling.
Yeah, this could be a podcast in itself, but this could end up being a two-part series. But
we've done that before.
We have done that before. But yeah, I was working in the movie business in Austin. And I'd been
I love
doing
how
it.
He just throws that out, you know. What? Oh, I was working in the movie business. Okay.
Well, wait till you hear this guy's story. So, but yeah, I was dabbling in it, and I finally decided after several years it was time to move to L.A. And I forget the movie, but I was working on a film, and I was a big Kevin Costner fan. And the lady that was driving me to set every day, you know, you go and park and then the vans would pick you up.
Wasn't it Bubble Boy? Wasn't it?
Yeah, that was in L.A. That was.
Oh, I thought it was there. Okay. No,
yeah, that was L.A. That, you know, that's a whole nother story, too. But it was Mary.
Yep.
She had on it was a baseball jersey and it had For Love of the Game on it.
Mm.
And I asked her, I said, did you work on that movie? And she said, yes, I'm Kevin Costner's personal driver. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. Yeah. And so we became really good friends I was on this set for a month or so. And I think it was at the end of that set that I made the comment that I was moving to LA. And she's like, oh, I've got all these people. You need to call. And she gave me a bunch of numbers. And, you know, I called a couple of them. And, of course, nobody answers. I said, Mary, I said, nobody's answering. I'm not leaving a message. They're not going to call me back. She goes, well, I've got this one guy that I've worked with before. And if he does not answer, leave him a message. And he will call you back. I call Corey. And he answers the phone.
Oh, no. And you went humming, 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 right?
And I told him who I was and, you know, how I got his number. And he's like, oh, my God, anybody that's a friend of Mary's is a friend of mine. And I moved out to L.A. And I think it was day one. I think I just drove into town. And he was working on 13 Days, the Cuban Missile Crisis with Kevin Costner
and
Bruce Greenwood.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Every time I hear that, like, I can't believe I was even there. Like, you say that. I was there, and I can't believe it.
Yeah.
And when you know you have a really great life.
I know.
Yeah. I drive into town, and I think I called him day one. It may have been the next day. And he's like, yeah, I'm sitting here in the White House. So, you know, he gave me directions, come on over. And of course, it was this movie set, and I don't remember where it was, but it was, you know, I go and meet him and we're hanging out in the Oval Office of the White House, and I've got all those pictures somewhere.
But
yeah, it's time to bring him out.
Yeah, we hung out and he introduced me. Who was the director on that?
Roger Donaldson.
Yeah, so we go there and he's showing me around and then we end up having lunch with the director and you know, Kevin Costner and, you know, the whole crew. And I'm just looking around going, I just drove to L.A.
Things don't happen like this.
And here I am. And from that point, he ended up getting me in fact, I was filling in as...
For Mark Thompson, you started out.
Yeah, Kevin Costner's stand-in for a week.
You were Kevin Costner.
If I weren't
already in love with this man and in awe, he just sealed the deal right there.
Here's how that whole thing works. So Mary was married when she met him. It was Mary Delaney. She was single when I met her on Waterworld. She, Kevin, and Mark Thompson and I became friends on this movie. Mary and I hung out a lot. Because we were stuck on an island together.
Mm-hmm.
And
there's nothing wrong with that sentence.
No, there's nothing wrong with that sentence at all. It was amazing. I would read it every day of that movie over. But we became close. So when Mary, you know, said that this is a guy that she wanted to help and thought was amazing, I respected and valued that incredibly. And so when Mark needed some time off, who'd been with Kevin for years and years and years, and I said, well, I think I have a guy that would be a replacement unless you have someone to bring in. He goes, who is it? I introduced him, and he goes, yeah, let's have that guy do it. Because it's a very coveted job, obviously. I mean, he's been with him for 30 years as a state. That's how those kind of teams roll. To me, the beauty of being a bumpkin from Walla Walla, Washington, not much but Wimberley, that has fallen into the film industry, I should no more be there than, you know what I mean? Like literally. So when I can do what I did with Rodney, which is break the fourth wall, he already had the fourth wall broken. He'd worked on projects down there. But when you arrive in Los Angeles, you walk on the set of the Kevin Costner movie and get a job.
Yeah, my first gig in LA was Kevin Costner stand-in, and yeah, then Mark came back and they kept me on as whatever, and then I ended up getting a small little bit part uncredited role, but it was and then it just
And then we traveled. Remember, we did that thing for Disney that I took you on the road.
Yeah, I was trying to remember how that worked the other day, or it was something with Whoopi Goldberg.
Yeah, it was for the California Adventure, the park, when California Adventure Disney had opened, and it was a huge propaganda piece for Disney. It was going to play every 15 minutes in perpetuity in this park, and it was literally the history of California. It was like, come be a part of the dream, and it started at the first day of shooting was that Chumash Indian Village with 200 real Chumash Indians doing the real village life with three cameras rolling at sunrise. And this was a $13 million short film that had was not an answer. You just had to get it done in 13 days. So we spent $1 million a day over the course of that.
Worked on the movie 13 days.
After we worked on synchronicities. We shot in Puree, Colorado. We shot in San Francisco. We shot in Morro Bay. We shot all over Orange County. And that was like private jets, like whatever it took to make this thing happen for Disney was what we did. I worked more in that 13 days than I had at that point in a lot of projects because it was just, it was not an option.
And Rodney, I just learned more about your movie career and experience in the last 5 minutes.
Well, he just reminded me of all the stuff I'd forgotten.
You're either very humble or you have a really bad memory.
Well, I'm sure a combination of the two. Has he told you about Pearl Harbor?
Oh, well, that's what he's famous for. Oh, yeah, that's an iconic photo, and everybody knows it. Rodney, save the dog.
The puppy guy. Yeah, the puppy guy. Wait, you know the puppy guy? I get that one. Yeah, I know the puppy guy. Well, what I've enjoyed about Rodney is watching him. Like, he can forget all of these things because he stays in the moment of where he is. Like, sitting in that jacuzzi with you. Yeah, I don't really think I'm interested in photography. Like, literally, that was the sentence. I'm like, really? What do you mean? No, I think I want to pursue photography. I'm like, that's awesome. That would be really cool. Cut to this guy's life.
Internationally awarded photographer opening his own gallery. Do you know about the gallery, Corey?
Yes, I'm super excited about
it. Isn't that awesome? I mean, all of his fans, and they are legion, are excited about this. So.
Yeah, but it's the next chapter. You're going to have to come down for the opening.
Oh, wouldn't that be fun?
You know it, man. You know, as a matter of fact, a movie that I am engaged with might be in, I want to say, they're looking at San Antonio, I think. I don't know. Anyway, in June, I could possibly be in Texas for a project if everything falls together. I'm co-producing a movie. I get to play a small role in it, too.
Oh, yeah?
It's not
nice.
Yeah, they want me to AD it, and I said, I will not AD a non-union project, but I will bring you the AD staff, and I will. This is a role that I'd like to play. And if you guys are open to these things, then I will happily organize your entire project. So far, so good. Ralph Winter is the executive producer on it. He's the guy that did all this X-Men. It's one of his passion projects.
Yeah. So, before you get in it, let's back up to you on your.
Rodney.
How
bold. Well, yeah.
I want to like know your background on, because your background on how you got started in the film business is so interesting. And I want to go back to your skate punk days in Walla Walla, Washington.
He did spill the beans on some of it before we called you. So
And, well, all up to your first role. And
Yeah, sure. I mean, and it is. It's kind of fun because what I love about your podcast is that you travel and things just unfold before you and you capture it with the camera and you have people around you that are wanting to tell the stories. And that's my entire life. I'm a guy that's just in awe. You know, at 12 years old, I heard an ad on the radio, come be an extra for a major motion picture being shot here. And I thought, well, that sounds interesting to me. I love movies. I've always wanted to see that. I'm 12. So I go out and I tell my mom, I want to be an extra in a movie. She's like, what does that mean? It's like, the guy on the radio said, if I call this line, I can sign up and then I get paid to be in the stands. It was a film called Personal Best, directed by Robert Towne. It was written and directed by Robert Towne. It starred Mario Hemingway.
I remember that movie, yeah.
Yeah, about the lesbian.
Right.
And so my mom's a very religious Christian pastor woman. And she's like, okay, yeah, why don't you let you do that? Like, and what's so strange about my mom, I was 12. And I convinced her that it was a good idea to let me go. She goes, well, how will you get there? So I'll ride my bike. She's like, you're 12 years old. You're going to ride your bike 4 miles across town to Hayward Field. I'm like, if you'll let me. Well, what about your paper route? Well, it wasn't my paper route. She pimped me. She got a paper route. That was what that was. I did get the money. I mean, that was how I paid for most of the parts and stuff like that. But that was her deal. You know, she was very
some mom.
Yeah, you know, she was all about opportunity and you know, we had some rough patches in our life together. But there's one thing I can say about my mom is that she always encouraged me to reach toward.
It's wonderful.
Lofty goals and dreams that most people would just look at you and laugh at. Mm. So she said, you know, you seem like you have it all together. 12 years old. If you can talk one of your friend's parents into letting them go with you, I'd feel more comfortable. So I picked my friend Brian Dunn, whose father was a doctor and his mother was a lawyer. And I went and I laid out the whole pitch to them and I convinced them. And we arrived on that set at 5 a.m. and I knew the minute I stepped up to the table to get my voucher to sign in as an extra. And when the guy said to me, okay, go fill that out and go get some breakfast. I said, I don't have any money. He goes, no, it's all free. It's all free. I said, it's free. And there was a table of donuts and there was a breakfast sandwich with bacon and eggs and the smell, the sound, all those people. I went, this is home. I want to be here forever.
What you're describing is exactly what I felt.
Yeah.
The business is, I mean, it is your work, it is your play, it's your social life, it's your friends, it's your family.
Yeah.
It's everything. You've got nothing to worry about when you're on a movie set.
And they had you at donuts.
They had me at donuts. You know, and today I've cut them out of my diet, you know, this is everything. And so what was funny about that situation was my friend Brian, his parents were very well educated, obviously. My parents are wonderful people, but they didn't have a social security number for me. And one of the things on the voucher was I had to fill out a social security number. So I looked at Brian. What is this? Do you have one? He like rattled his off. I'm like, oh, shit. So I went to the payphone and I called my father. Pushed 0. Do you remember when he used to call people?
Yeah.
And he accepted the collect call at his office. And I said, man, I need your social security number. I said, do you have my social security? He goes, no, I don't think your mom's got it for you yet. And I said, well, I need yours. He goes, why? I said, I'm filling out this voucher in your name. I'm 12, and I've already figured out how to game the system. Totally illegally. If that happened on my set today, that is such a huge breach of so many child labor laws. But we did, and I was there for 3 weeks. Brian, on the other hand, he was done 2 hours after we ate and got on the set. And he's like, I'm out. This is not for me. So I had to lie that entire 2 weeks that Brian, we had a great time today. It was really cool. Because if I, you know, if he wasn't there, I thought my mom would make me not do it. So 3 weeks in, my mom and dad, we have having a vacation we've been doing for years and years and years. And that was my favorite thing of the year, obviously. Except this year, after introducing myself to movies, I had a whole plan. You guys are going to go camping. I get fed twice a day here. I'll come home. I'll have a bowl. I promise I will put my bowl in the dishwasher and I'll take care of the house. And I won't let Brian in because no friends can come in when the parents aren't there. I got all the rules. Yeah, they had none of that. They pulled me off that set and took me camping. And I'm surprised someone didn't drown me. Rocks around me.
How did you segue that first incredible initial experience into a lifelong career? It's you know, fun to go and have that great first time, but you've managed to sustain this.
Well, you know what's amazing is the depression that comes after this, because this is an addiction. I'm also an addictive personality.
Yeah.
recovery, because I learned that about myself. And I remember the end of that project, the suicidal depression that came over. It'll never happen. So my dad, being my dad, he's like, well, God, here's what I would do if I was you. I would get out the phone book. I would call every news station and anything that looks like video production and just talk to people. I'm like, it's a great idea. I also wanted to be a DJ. So I was very, you know, like that with all the DJs in town. How do you be a DJ? Read everything out loud. You know, they told me all the things. So I started calling all these. And I ended up getting an opportunity with a man named Paul. I'm still in contact with this man today. I started talking to him at like 12 years old, 13 years old. And I asked him if I could come watch him make a commercial or watch him do things. And I went from watching him carrying the cases, being a PA, to then he started directing things outside of what he did at the news channel. He started this little production company. He started doing like educational videos for kids. So I was the drug addict kid. Drugs videos when I was in that space. And, so I would carry the cases and I would act in these things. And it was just super, super fun. And from there, Stand By Me came into town. And that was the unbelievable, like this, and it was exactly the same situation. Come be an extra in a major motion picture. Mm-hmm. I called a line. Now, what are the odds that it would happen one time? Mm. But two times. Okay. So I'm a guy that believes in synchronicity. We were having that talk before offline. And so for people listening, Rodney is the same kind of cat. I want to be a photographer, he said. In 2019, I'm like, dude, that's awesome. Let's see what that looks like. Well, y'all know what it looks like, and you're part of his adventure. So my adventure began with two phone calls to be an extra. And the second one, literally, what is your height, weight, hair color, eye color? That was literally all I left on that line. I was now a drama major in high school. I was in my first drama class, and I was not acting in any plays. I was more the stage manager. I was the makeup artist and the stage manager. I was terrified of performing. But I found my people because I didn't fit really. I was already an odd kid because of my predisposition to the issues of alcoholism and drug addiction. I was raised by a horde, a pack. You know, both my grandfathers have died of this disease. And like it was a pretty ugly situation in our home at times because it was just dysfunctional. So I found my people. The drama kids were my kids. So the call comes. I'm asleep after school one afternoon. My sister pounds on the door and goes, there's somebody from Columbia Pictures on the phone.
Yeah.
13 years old. Exactly. Yeah. So I got on the line and there was a woman named Catherine Wilson then. She's now Catherine Crystal. She's married to a really wonderful man named Philip. And she was like, okay, based on your vital statistics, the director is looking for people that are your age, your height, your this, your that. We would like you to come in and be seen by us and see if you can do a reading. Okay.
How old were you at this point?
16.
Okay.
That was 16 years old. That was my
12 and a half.
Yeah. No, I wish it was that. I mean, it was many years of pining and wondering and doing all those videos and trying to figure out how to be a movie star. You know, that was really my goal. It's not my goal anymore. So I go to school the next day and I talk to my drama teacher, who was also my English teacher. This is important later. So I'm like, Mr. Siegel, got this call. Who's messing with me? Is it Peter? Who's messing with me? There's no movie. He goes, no. Oh, no. There's a picture coming to town. My agent has told me. This is a guy who is in Springfield, Oregon, the drama coach, who's also the referee for every soccer organization in the entire tri-state area.
This is the history teacher.
Exactly. In drama and English. And, you know, anyway, so he's like, no, mine. Has told me that I'm probably going to get an opportunity to read. So you need to take it seriously. I'm like, okay. So he helped me put together a fake resume that was the scenes that class as if I had been in the play. He was like, Corey, but you need a performing name. I'm like, performing name? My name is Corey Scott Ballard. And my mom spelled it with a K. It's already weird. It's never going to be on a license plate at the Grand Canyon. Yeah. You know, it's never going to happen for me that way. So I was already self-conscious about that. And he's like, no, I think you should be Corey Scott. I'm like, I am not changing my name. Mm. Not happening. Okay, well, at least put Corey Scott Pollard on the resume. I'm like, all right, I'll do that. So all these made-up things, other than the makeup. Makeup experience was real. I did the real makeup for all the plays. But everything else, I hadn't done a single thing. So he made this resume up for me. said, I go to this first audition, and it went so horribly. They had me with another actor. I read, shaking sides. And, like, just, and I get up, and the two of us leave the room, and the guy calls to me. He's like, hey, you know, that was really awful, but there's something about you. And I was like, did you just be like, was that a compliment, or did you just, I think you hated me? Like, I was so confused, and I went home, and I literally called John, and I was practically crying. I'm like, I don't know. I think I screwed it up. He's like, oh, you'll be fine. A month, nothing. Then Jonathan gets his opportunity for his audition, and he calls my father. He's doing it during a school day. He's taking off time from the school day to go in on a weekday. He calls my dad and said, would you consider letting me sign Corey out from school and take him? I really think Corey could do this stuff. I want him to see an audition. The referee guy. Yeah. I love Jonathan. Still in touch as well. And he's like, my dad said, yeah. So I went. I walked in the door. Now Catherine, that woman that called, is there. She goes, oh, my God. You are exactly what he's looking for. And Jonathan, back up. Jonathan says to me, make sure you wear a t-shirt and jeans. It's a greaser thing. You got to be looking like a greaser. So I wore a t-shirt and jeans and went in. And she goes, you get in front of the camera right now. And I said, it's his audition. I'm just here to learn. Here's what I did. I got in front of it. And they said, tell us your name, your age, your height, your weight, and your color. There was no audition. Like, I already bailed on the bad audition the first time.
Oh, my goodness.
Second time I'm doing this. Third time's a charm. Huh. So my friend Peter, I mentioned before, was the – he's the kid – God bless him. I love him to death. But I still have scars from how competitive he was. He had to be the best at it. I'm the, we're all going to do this together. Yeah. You know? And he was so good at everything. Everything he was good at. He's still acting. He is in the actors gang in Los Angeles, and he does amazing like activist work on top. He is living that actor's life. I have sold out. I'm in like, nobody's business. I haven't even pursued acting. So he gets his audition, but his parents are out of town. And he's like, could you drive me? Because my parents let me drive the pickup all the time. And I said, sure. My parents said, you can, but we have a wedding to go to. It's Christy Wilson's wedding. And you drop him off and you get back. Well, a smart AD kid would have dressed for the wedding. It was so close to where I was going, but I didn't do that. So I got there. I dropped him off and I watched him. I walked in with him and I watched him walk up the mezzanine in the Hilton Hotel in Green, Oregon. I watched him sign in at a table. And I was like, huh. Wonder what would happen if I walked up to that table. So he went into a room and I walked up to the table. Hi, I'm Corey Scott Pollard and I'm here. And they're like, okay. And they flipped through a page, another page, the page. She's like, I am so sorry. There must be some mistake. I said, well, what do you mean a mistake? This is the auditions for the movie, right? Why would I be here if I didn't get a call? I am making this shit up. And she ends up flipping one more page and goes, oh my God, there's a mistake. You're not supposed to be here until next Sunday. But since you're here, the director's in town. We'll just put you in and you won't have to come next week. I'm okay. Still, no idea that it's Rob Reiner. Meathead. I grew up watching All in the Family. Final Tap was in the theaters that summer. One of my favorite movies of all time.
Yeah.
And so they now walk me into the room with Peter and he's livid. He's looking at me like, what are you doing in my space? And then it happens. We have these sides, and the door opens. It's Rob Reiner.
Wow.
I'm like, I didn't know what to think. I didn't know what to do. So I'm doing the scene, and he's got my resume in his hand now. And the entire time that we're actually doing the scene, he's going, Corey Scott. And I'm like, he's literally saying it out loud. I'm like, oh, my God. I am so bad that he wants to remember my name so that he will never have to deal with me again. Like, that's where my mind went.
Mm-hmm.
So I leave, I go home, and I get in trouble. You get your suit on, and you get in that truck and take your sister. Get the. They leave. I get in the truck with my suit on, and I'm passing the hotel again as I'm going, and I have no idea what possessed me. I pulled into the hotel again. I walked in, I walked up to the table again, and now Catherine Wilson is sitting there. I haven't seen her since the very second audition, and she is doing this. Oh, my God, you. And I said, I'm sorry, did someone find my wallet? I am so I had to lie about being there. I couldn't just let her tell me what she was going to tell me. And she said, you got the part. Hmm. He closed it. You left and you got the part.
Yeah.
And I just went, oh my God, my life changed. Literally in that moment, I was a different human being. Even though I was the same kid running down the same direction, I had one of the greatest opportunities of my life that has – it opened the door for me in Hollywood. When I came here and tried to become an on-set dresser and all the other things, like the story of getting to the next place is just ridiculous because they all look at me and go, you have this classic movie as an actor on your resume. Why do you want to move furniture? Esteem. I don't think there's anything else I can do.
Was after that, when you finished that, how long was it before you moved to LA?
I finished that the summer of between my sophomore and my junior year, and I moved to LA immediately following my senior year. So I was 18 when I moved. I literally graduated from high school and left. I left in October, the year I graduated from high school.
And it was with the intention of acting.
Did you care? I didn't care. I just knew that Hollywood was calling my name. I knew I had a calling card with the Rob Reiner stuff. I had no idea. I had no structure. I had no agent, manager, anything. What was going on is that River Phoenix and I were still in contact. He was riding high, literally and figuratively. At the time we met, I have a signed script from River Phoenix that says, you need to watch yourself and slow down because you have a future in this business. And when I moved there, October 31st, 1988, that was the night he passed away. And it threw me because I thought there's my, you know, and that's how sick I was. It wasn't even about the friendship at that point. I was such a drug addict. I just wanted to get somewhere. And here I was there now. And I was living with an actor from a movie I worked on behind the camera. That's a whole other story, how I missed an opportunity to be in a movie. They wanted to put me in a movie in Eugene, Oregon, but because I was a stoner and I went to fight forest fires to earn money to move to California, I missed the opportunity altogether. Like the fact that I have now got 33 years in this business is again, an indication that there's a plan that if I just slow down and listen instead of think I got a plan and figure it out, it continues to happen. I mean, it's happening again right now as I'm moving into new realms of producing and organizing and social activism that combines all of my passions with filmmaking and all these things. It's just beyond my comprehension.
Yeah, I was trying to explain that to Chick before we called you. And, you know, it's like you and I, you know, we've been such good friends for so long now. And sometimes so we go a year or two without talking, we pick right back up where we were, but whether we go a week without talking or a year without talking, every time we talk, he's got some crazy. I'm going to go speak at Cambridge, or I'm going.
That was wow. That was Yale. I got to speak at Yale. That was insane. I have no education. No edumacation.
Yeah. He's always got these amazing adventures going on.
No, and that's what I think I love about our relationship is that we have this connection and we're both open to when a desire is placed in your heart. It's different than saying, I want to do something. Both of us are guys that are like, would that even be possible? It's not like I want to do this. I'm like, And you speak it and it happens. Like you're talking about me. You have a gallery opening. Dude, did you think that?
We called you. So.
Yeah, right. So anyway, the reality of it is that we have that connection. And when you're in what I call that flow, that conscious space, and your desires are placed within you, I believe there's a power greater than control. Like I just cannot deny it because I have tried to kill. Like here's how I moved. Jake, here's how I moved to Los Angeles. You know what I thought was important? I had my stereo. $150 and a quarter ounce of marijuana. That's what I thought was for me to move to Los Angeles. And all of that stuff, half of it was gone by the time I arrived because you know where I decided to spend the night? Do you know anything about California? I was so stoned and tired, I pulled off at the Grapevine and spent half of my money on a hotel room and $10 on a room service beer at 18 thinking, oh my God, I'm getting caught. And the beer came and I got the beer and I'm so cool. And I got in the car, and I was in Los Angeles within an hour in the morning. Does that give you any indication of how unaware I was of what I was doing at the time? And the fact that I ended up in Los Angeles sober, having raised a family and having worked on the things that are on my Internet Movie Database page is beyond my comprehension. It's just, it's a gift. And now that I'm moving into these political realms and social activism, using filmmaking and all these things with prison reform, like, it's just beyond. It's just such a gift.
Would you back up a little bit and tell us a little bit about that? I mean, like everything else I've heard, to some people, that sounds like a real leap, a real segue. That kind of torques the brain there. You've been an AD, an assistant director title.
That's what I was going to say, is we need, I think we need to go cover that just a little bit, because I think that's what's led to this, what you're doing now, is your career as a second AD. Or you first AD too, haven't you?
I've been firsting for now 15 years.
Yeah, because you were second AD on 13 Days, right?
13 Days, and for many years after.
That was your gig for a long time.
A long time.
Yeah.
I thought I was a career first. Second. I thought I'd never move up to being a first AD. And just literally, when you go from being an extra, then your next gig is a principal player in a classic film that is on the annals of history.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then you go move furniture. And then you are the prop guy. And then someone says, hey, I think you'd be a better prop guy. I mean, a better AD than you are a prop guy. And I'm thinking, I'm so offended.
For those of us like myself, I mean, I'm movie addict, and maybe that's the wrong word, a cinemaphile for sure. I'm not aware of the distinctions of first AD and second AD and prop guy and furniture guy.
Let me walk through it. Okay, let me walk through it. So a swing gang set dresser was the first job I got when I missed the opportunity to be in a movie. And what a swing gang set dresser does, if we were shooting your situation right here, what I'm looking at on my screen, the swing gang set dresser would bring the table in, the prop guy would bring the microphones and your board in, and that's what they're responsible for. So I was the first thing I did was bring the table to the set and take the table away. And then whatever was in that house before, I would put it back into position. Mm. Then the prop guy, that my favorite was the prop guy stuff, because we were guns, knives, like all the cool stuff. And it also sucked, because when you're in a bar or a restaurant, every drink, every piece of food, everything that anyone touches is that's what you're responsible for. And the continuity of that stuff while they're touching it, whatever the cigarette they're smoking. Hmm. Oh God, no, wait, don't get that one. You got this one, because last take it was not that long. And you know, so there's continuity. There's so much to learn about what happens to take two people like you and put them on. There would be 40 people standing on the other side of this camera right now. And you guys are supposed to act like you're the only ones in the room. Like, it's the most chaotic and incredible environment. And I've learned from literally touching every portion of it through my entire career. Hmm. Guy, there was an AD who saw my personality, saw me deal with some stress, saw me deal with some things, who said, I think you would be a better AD than you are a prop guy. And I was so offended. I'm like, do you think I suck as a prop guy? Why? You know, I had no idea it was not for me. I had no idea that he was giving me a compliment, because that's how I hear things. That's my brain. Uh-huh. And so he gave me that opportunity turned into what was actually literally the ER pilot, but it was before Lance Gentile.
Really?
Leslie Lincoln Glatter directed this thing for HBO. They said, well, you know, to Lance Gentile, who was a doctor who wrote this beautiful series about it, we like the pilot, and we'll just do that as a one-off. So we literally did all of that steady camming from one room to the next, the scenes linking together. I did this while we were. As a PA and an assistant director, what you're responsible for on the movie is now telling the people who bring the table in what time and day the table needs to be there. Telling the prop guy, here's what the director wants. This is the kind of microphone that it's going to be. You find it and make sure that it's here on this day and this time. Hey, you two actors, I need you to be in the makeup chair at this time, putting on these clothes that have been chosen by the costume department so that we can do these scenes on this day.
You're the babysitter for the movie set.
Oh, I need somebody like that in my life. What to wear, how to look.
Yeah, I mean, but think about it. The kid that thought it was a good idea to move to Los Angeles with his stereo and a quarter ounce of pot is now managing.
Telling
what to do.
A few more details.
Scary.
That was a kid. I had no idea I had a skill. And I was placed in the environment. And again, that's just, it's the same thing that we were just talking about, Rodney. It's just that reality that when you walk into a situation and you know it's where you're supposed to be, and you continue, and then someone tells you, hey, why don't you try this? That's what my entire career has been.
Mm-hmm.
Just doing what's been put in front of me, not a clue how I got there. And yet 33 years later, there's a massive work that I've been invited to be a part of for whatever
that's
beyond my comprehension.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're very similar in that. I daily, I'm going, how did I get here? Yeah. Of all the people who'd be doing the things that I'm doing, I'm the one doing it right now.
I'm curious, are you finding at this stage in your life that there's less anxiety around what's next?
Oh, that's all gone.
Isn't it crazy?
Yeah, because
do you remember how fearful you used to be about these things?
Yeah, I've learned that things just happen the way they're supposed to now, and
the way they're supposed to.
I don't worry about any of that anymore. And
yeah, and I'm having that same experience as I'm moving toward these realms where the prison work and all those things happened because some really bad things happened.
Mm-hmm.
If you're my life and you're thinking, oh, this guy's heading somewhere. Look at that, he got that. And he's that guy, and this is going to be amazing because if he goes through that thing, this will happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the Jack Ryan experience, you know, that I shared with you, where I ended up being let go. I was going to actually do a human resources thing and actually file a literal complaint about some verbal abuse that was happening, and I didn't have to. They fired me, and they had to pay me to leave. And I ended up available to walk into that prison situation that I discussed about.
Okay, I'm really curious about that. Rodney knows I love to hear about segues. I think there are a lot of missing segues in your stories, which I find absolutely fascinating. You just said I walked into that prison situation. If I was a director, I'd say, all right, let's put the mark there. Go.
Yeah, put the mark there and let's talk. Okay, so essentially, I come from a family. My grandmother was a religious person. She had a heart for people in prison, and she ended up working as a corrections officer. I had no idea that there would be any connection to that. And the love that she had for people who had made mistakes and that they deserved opportunities. Now, we paint those people in our media as horrible people. Well, there's a bunch of those in there, for sure. There's no question that there are people in prison that should never be there. But there are people who are stuck in a justice system that is designed literally almost to be impossible to get out of. It's not a broken system. It was designed literally as legal slavery. Like literally the first policing in this country were people going out and looking for chattel, looking for slaves and putting them in. That's how policing started in our country. And it has not gone far from that. So it's an interesting conversation. It's a long one. And so I didn't know how interested I was in it. I knew that it was bad, and I've had a fear my entire life that I can't believe I got away with the things I got away with as a kid. I have friends who were in prison for things that and I was just that guy that got away. Just the guy that got away. And I didn't know that about myself until I started coming to the place where the jobs that I started getting became less about, hey, dude, come help us do this project. And I had an agent. And it was like I was going up for these huge jobs. And what I learned in that environment is there are plenty of people that I can enjoy their movies and what they do, but I don't ever have to meet them or work with them, or shall I say put up with them. Because there are some people that have such interesting ways of working in that environment that is so toxic.
Mm.
And so I experienced a bunch of those when I realized I'm getting successful. I'm doing these big, great things. And I started, at what cost? I used to love it because it was my friends saying, come help us. And I would fall in love with the project or something that someone had written that I knew. And it was all these things that were just, there was connection to them. Mm. Now I was just working on the biggest stuff, traveling the world. And I had a bad experience with a verbally abusive human being. And I realized I didn't need to be in that environment. And I didn't care how much money, that I couldn't do it. So I literally was kneeling next to the monitors thinking, oh my God, this is it. I am going to write a letter to human resources and say, this is a toxic human. I'm not going to do the work that we're doing here in this hallway with one person with a gun and go to another country and put hundreds of people with guns in their hands with a man who doesn't understand the safety of what we're doing and is arguing with me about it. And he's verbally abusing me for actually looking out for the safety. That's my job, to make sure that it's safe and that action is amazing and that we can do all this stuff. And I thought, I'm not doing the fight. 2 hours later, the producers walk in. How are you? Oh, let's go do this. It was clear to me that he was getting rid of me. And I said, I was going to write a letter. Now it's your fault. I mean, not your fault. It's your problem. You can do whatever you want, and I will absolutely leave. So I'm back in L.A. with my ego bruised and thinking, I don't understand what's happening. And a friend of mine from Nashville, whom I'm supposed to be having dinner with in Los Angeles on that night, calls me, and he's in tears. He goes, you have got to do this. I'm like, dude, what? Are we having dinner tonight? Where are you? Yeah, we're having dinner. Yeah, you need to come to prison. I'm like, what are you talking about? He goes, I'm in Pelican Bay. And I said, Dustin, Pelican Bay is in Northern California on the border. Are you coming to Los Angeles for dinner tonight? I'm confused. No. He's a man from Nashville. What it turned out doing, I said, where's your wife? She's with me. I'm like, what? What? Why are you guys in prison? And he explained that he had gone there on a volunteer opportunity with a place called Defy Ventures, that they were doing business coaching. And what they do is Defy Ventures created this curriculum, become the CEO of your new life. And they would teach, and they had people from huge organizations and big schools come in and teach how to do a business plan. They have a huge manual that if you're willing, they will come in and teach you how to put together a business plan, pitch it, do all these things, and there's money that can be gone. So when you get out, or you can start a business while you're in that someone else can go and run, that hires felons. They're trying to get the recidivism down and doing it from the inside out. So I said, well, that's interesting. I'm available now. I've got nothing on the plate because I got fired. Let me check this out. So he gives me a phone number to call. I call the number, and it was the strangest thing that a friend of mine that I also knew from Nashville answered the phone. And I thought, how is this possible? And she's like, that's interesting. I've thought about you a number of times as I've just gotten to this organization in the last 6 months, but I wasn't sure. Well, now you're calling. I think you'd be interested. I'm like, well, I'm calling. She signs me up to go into California City, and then I can't remember what the other second prison was, and just volunteer. Just walk in this situation. They take a bunch of professional people in to stand up in front of a room full of inmates and say, hey, here's an opportunity to learn something. There's coaching. We will come back and do, you know, all kinds of other coaching with you. Do you want to join this program? And it was really powerful being in that room that day. They asked me, they asked all the volunteers to come up and dance up the aisle in front of people and explain who you are, what your greatest accomplishment is, and why you're here. And in that moment, I had an epiphany. At that point, I was some 3,000 days sober. Today, I'm 5,496 days sober. I didn't do count days because I'm a whack job. I can't really I'm like normal and have a life. But so I'm standing in front of these men, and I know she wants me to lead with the movie guy because that's what everybody sees me as, and that's been a problem for me my whole life. That whole thing in Stand By Me changed. I was the punk kid. Nobody wanted to be around, but the minute my picture was in the paper, everybody wanted to be me. They wanted to buy drugs from me. That's experience in life, and it's been very uncomfortable. So I lead with, my name is Corey Pollard. My greatest accomplishment is the number of days I'm sober, and I'm here because I realize that I'm your asshole friend that got away. Someone saw something and invested in me. I'm literally tearing up. Something in me and gave me opportunity after opportunity, and I'm sitting here and you're sitting there. And if there's anything I can do, I can't get you in the movie business. Oh, yeah, I work in the movie business. But if I can invest any of the kind of energy and time into your character to help you see that the worst mistake you've made is not the only thing about you that's important, I just want to be a part of that. And so I sat in a circle with a bunch of different people on that day, and we talked through business ideas that they had. I saw people, what I identified about that program was, rah, 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 CEO of your new life, you know, fill out this application. And you saw guys' hands go down because they couldn't fill out an application because they couldn't write. Because they couldn't. And I said to the woman, the CEO, I said, look, I think it's awesome what you're doing, but not everybody in here is going to run a business. What about the guys that are sitting in that room, and every time you talk about doing all of these great things to make a business, all they want to do is fill out an application. All they want to do is know that somebody who's making a business is going to hire them. How are you connecting these men? She goes, oh my God, we've been doing this 8 years and I've never thought of it. No one has ever said that to us. I'm like, I see things very differently. You know, I'm totally open to what you're doing, but I think the rah-rah is devastating some of these people, and they're going to be even more crushed when they go back to their cell block. Mic drop. My daughter had a soccer game. I didn't ride on the bus with everybody, and I left, and they started asking me questions, started talking about strategy, and then she left that organization, and it didn't go the way I wanted it to go. Very upset. But all my ideas landed in that place, and another man from Washington State came down and said, I think your program's amazing. Here are the things I'm doing. He was doing those things that I was talking about. So we partnered and started something up there. From that came meeting two men that we've started a production company with called Unincarcerated Productions. We are creating awareness around a word we've made up. Becoming unincarcerated in your mind is the moment, whether you're standing in prison, you have a drug addiction, you have a bad habit that you would like to quit, when you realize I can change. What do you do from that point? So partnering with community organizations, education components that already exist, we're trying to create a pipeline, and it's going very well, from prison to corporations, to businesses. They are hiring people in the regular world, the millennials and these folks that take up all your time training, spend all the money training, and they just ghost and move to the next opportunity. Mm. There are people that can do all these jobs that if they had an opportunity when they came out and then they began to get the community support that they needed, the recidivism rate will go down. The studies across the country in the places that still have vocational programs is that the recidivism rate is 90%, 80% in that zone that they don't come back. And it's not just the skill set of jobs that they need. It's also the support of the community. And so these organizations all exist, and we're trying to become the magnet that puts these groups together and connects them with the other humans. And it's kind of happening. We've got some pretty interesting people. I told you about the Stedman Graham conversation that's happening right now. There's a lobbyist in Florida who's opening doors for us to get into the Florida State Corrections and the Sheriff's Department to offer programs. And what we do is connect them with, in Seattle, we're talking with Microsoft, we're talking with Amazon, and showing them that if you came in and sat with some of these humans who are about to get out, they're humans. There are people that have done horrible things, will never get out of prison. There's a ton of people that just need the opportunity to get out. And because the system's designed the way it is, they're going into debt and they'll never be able to pay off that debt. Mm-hmm. And so they get out, they get discouraged, and they end up back in. Mm-hmm. So we're literally taking people into offices, getting them in, talking, and then go, by the way, did you know this guy's a felon? Why don't you come in and see some of these people before they get out? Identify people that you're interested in. We will produce the content that trains them before they get out so that you have people ready for the jobs that you want and create us a pipeline. And so we're training the people to make the videos. So we're hoping to offer, you know, this work in other parts of the country with other corrections departments and with other, you know, working in labor. Labor departments are really the people that have funds to do this stuff because it's in their best interest. So if you move it from the corrections department into the labor and into these other political entities, we might actually make a difference. So we're working super hard to create these opportunities.
Is this the area of somebody put a little, you know, word in my head that you have a new podcast yourself?
Mm-hmm.
And is this the realm? Is this
the
playing field, the conversation? Yeah. Could you tell us about that?
Sure.
What you're hoping to accomplish and how that became, sounds like another natural outcome of an opportunity and you just went with it. So
the pandemic caused that.
Sounds familiar, Rodney.
That's why we're here. That's why we started.
We yapped about it for 2 years.
Yes, yeah. We had people that were coming out of prison that we were going to begin documenting their experiences and trying to create some reality series and some things. Coronavirus hit and everything shut down. Mm-hmm. All the in-prison programs that we were engaged with, not that we run, but that we were engaged with, that we were helping, you know, document and make sure that people saw and were aware of, shut down. People who were supposed to be released were no longer going to be released. Mm-hmm. Outside were getting coronavirus and they couldn't show up for court dates and then you couldn't do it in person. Like, and it just... everything ground to a halt. And so we thought, gosh, you know, we have such a passion for this. We did two things. We produced some stuff online that's on our YouTube, Unincarcerated Productions YouTube channel, that was recently unincarcerated inmates talking about, oh, so you've never been in solitary confinement. Let us teach you some skills, what it's like to maybe not be able to go anywhere. And we did these kind of recently folks out and it didn't huge status, but the point is we just kept moving toward a goal. And then we realized, you know what we really need is it's the narrative, it's the story behind the story. Why are we doing this? So we came up with a season one of a podcast that is each of the members of our team, two of which are felons who have gotten out and done incredible things with their lives, Spencer Oberg and Vic Chopra. And then we have a lawyer who's a punk rock or punk rock entertainment lawyer who is a podcast producer and host.
How do you get that narrowed down?
Oh, he's amazing.
He's a punk rocker, or he represents punk rockers?
Both.
Like important distinction.
All of the above. Mm. You know, he is an amazing man. And then our COO, her father, was a corrections officer in Walla Walla State Penitentiary. Wait, what? Mm-hmm. Isn't it horrible? Didn't all of this start with his grandma and the interest that she had? So some of our writing programs are being developed right now in Walla Walla State Penitentiary. So we decided that my part of the vision for the whole thing is, okay, so Hollywood, yeah, I can take your money and I can turn it into anything. Clearly, I've been blessed with a skill set, and I have a whole lot of people that like working with me in that really crazy environment that you know much about, mm-hmm. Rodney. And it's not always fun, and somebody has to try to make it fun. So I've got that. That's amazing.
If you can avoid the behind the scenes stuff, it is fun.
Yeah, right. Yeah, avoid the drama and the politics. Yeah. So essentially, that's fantastic. That's a good skill set. I have a passion for people. I want to make a difference. And so we came up with the idea to link these programs together, and I'm running a lot of that, and I'm really grateful that I get to be a part of that, on top of we're developing these other dramatic pieces that we're actually getting the rights from people's stories in prison. As a vertically integrated company, the podcasts that we're producing now, we have ours, which is season one on Incarcerated, the podcast, which is all the members of the team talking about why they're involved and what we're hoping this vision is. And my portion of that vision is to take people's stories, create educational content. Like, it's huge. And you would think none of it's possible. Yet people are lining up in the social media platform to help us. People are looking to. It's like the conversation. We just had the conversation at exactly the right time. So season two is us talking to people who have gotten out and are successful, the pitfalls that they have gone through, what their struggles are still currently, what the impact is on their families. The second podcast that we're producing right now that's completely unrelated to us as a company is called Justice Delayed, and it is the beginning of what we call the Sinclair case. Billy Wayne Sinclair and Jody Sinclair are a married couple. He was in Angola, a really corrupt and horrible prison, for 40 years. He went in for something that should have been manslaughter. He absolutely was guilty of robbing a store. And the guy he was robbing chased him out of the store. This is actually the case that made it a corporation bylaw that if you worked at a 7-Eleven and you were being robbed, you could not leave the counter. You just stood there, gave him the money, and walked away. Because this guy went after Billy Rain. He had a 22, and they ran out the door. He was hitting him with a broom and like a stick and all these things. And Billy just shot over his shoulder trying to get away and winged the guy in a way that he bled out. And some corrupt people, upset about the ex-football star working at the 7-Eleven who got himself into trouble by, he shouldn't have been attacking him. Nobody should have been in the situation. It should never have happened. They cooked his books. They got rid of evidence. They got rid of witnesses who said, oh my God, that guy was getting his ass kicked. He ran away. I mean, and they made it sound like he stood there and shot the guy point blank. It's on paper that that's what it was. They had witnesses who corroborated that stuff. And Billy Wayne's life was destroyed, and he was on death row for drugs and alcohol and all those things in prison. You can get all that stuff. He started to destroy himself that way. And then he woke up one day and he had what we call that unincarcerated moment. He's written two books. He's on his third right now. His wife has written a book about their experience. And essentially what happened is she came in, met him as a news reporter, fell in love with him. As she was in love with him, someone sent his file and she freaked out. She's like, oh my God, you didn't tell me any of this. You're a journalist. I thought you knew all that. And she's like, but this is horrible. I don't know if I can be running. He's like, that's the point I'm trying to tell you. Yes, I did rob the place. Yes, I did that. But the rest of it is not real. And that's what this system is doing to me. And so he had his moment. He got sober. He began to get education. He started writing letters. He ended up getting himself off of death row. Married, he's in prison for another 25 years, and they set on this journey to get him out. And we have the rights to their legacy, not just their stories and their books, but their. We're producing this podcast that is turning into every book that Jody ever wanted to write, because she's talking about everything she wants, and we transcribe the book, you know, and then we do it on demand so that when the books are available, we can put them out and people that are interested in this conversation can be a part of it. And the story, she ends up working with the FBI to expose this corruption, wears a wire. The corrupt legislature people find out about it, do their own investigation, hang a bunch of low-hanging fruit, put them away, which makes everything that Billy Wayne and Jody have done with the FBI inadmissible. So they're still protected. And so we're telling a story from 66 to 2007 when it gets out in various forms of dramatic reality and documentary form. It's a lot.
Wow.
Well, yeah. I mean, do you ever sleep? I mean, just the sheer passion and the energy must keep you on just overdrive in a wonderful way.
Yes and no. Yeah, no, what's amazing is that, like we were talking about, it's a Mr. Magoo thing. Hmm. I thought I needed to be on the big Jack Ryans. I thought I needed to be on the biggest movies in the world to get a well, that's what kills me. That's what gives me exhaustion, anxiety. Mm-hmm. Working on Chicago Fire, and I'm happier than I've ever been just being in the AD with a nice group of people on the ninth season of a show that every single person on that set wants to be here, is kind, professional, and wants to be there. And not every project is horrible. There are just plenty of people that I don't need to work with or be involved in their things, and I make those choices today. So I have more time in my life, and the beauty of all of this coming together is that this particular TV show is the only TV show ever in the history of me working where we work from Sunday to Thursday. So I have Fridays off. So everything you're hearing about has happened almost, or it's been 3 years of formulating and working with these guys. We produced the podcast in the pandemic in the last 4 months. Yeah. In the last 5 months, every Friday, we're just having these meetings and meeting these people and having these conversations to where now we're talking with Stedman Graham to rep his book and get his identity leadership courses put everywhere, but he wants to get them in prison, so we're responsible for that content.
So when you allowed the space to open up and just showed up in that space, all of these incredible things emerge.
And I even take a step further and ask, you know, God, Jesus, whatever just putting a label on it is ridiculous, and thinking you understand it and own it is crazy. For me, it is. I call it God, and I have a faith in this Christ thing, but it's not the circled wagons, sprinkle, dunk, kneel, or bow thing you see in the planet polarizing us politically in the country. But I just, what is your will for me today? Show me. And different things show up on the list. And I'm like, oh, that's crazy. Like literally the conversation I just had with the CEO from a company in Nashville that wants to train inmates to be on sales teams for large corporations. Yesterday was a conversation with a woman whose husband owns the company that services the jets for all the NFL teams, all the rock stars you can imagine, all the big billionaires in the world. He like services and contracts and does all those things. And he's like, God, we went into prison with Hustle 2.0. It's another one of these programs that we're engaged with. It changed our lives. We think we can get people to be trained in mechanical aeronautic training and come out of prison and work. And I said, what about manufacturing? Are you guys in touch with Gulfstream and those people? Oh my God, I know the owner of Gulfstream. Like, look at that. What if we created an education program where we're teaching them the mechanic skills and you put an engine in, you know, and some of those places still have vocational schools. So we'll start with the ones that do. Then we want to show that there's value in a county, in a state, investing in those things. And so are we just a production company?
I'm beginning to understand what you mean, seriously, about every time you two have a conversation. This is my first conversation with Corey, and I want to get him on the docket at a regular interval. I mean, I'm not going to sleep wondering what's next. It's inspiring. You're inspiring, and availability.
You know, who knows? Maybe I'm a lunatic. Maybe none of it's going to happen. But the reality is,
well, something great will.
Yeah.
If it's not
see,
that,
that's it. Like,
that
I'm
or something
afraid.
Better, as a friend of mine likes to say, this or something better. Yeah.
Because you can sit and cook your ideas. You can overthink, and I'm a big overthinker. You know, and it didn't really help me. I just, every time I showed up, the opportunities continued to present themselves. So the plan never worked. And so this is not necessarily a plan. It is a plan. Like, I see it. I see the dots that need to be connected. People, that's all impossible. I'm like, no, you know what's impossible is putting a television show on the air in 8 days. That's supposed to be impossible. Yet I've been doing that for 30 years. Now, what if I apply the same skill set and looking at different sets of problems and set time. It's no different than what I do, you know, and I just am tired of doing the same thing for 33 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I don't think you're in any danger of that.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you for being interested in it. It is a lot. You know, I think Rodney might have been one of the people who actually said this. You know, sometimes, Corey, talking to you is like taking a sip from a fire hose. It's a lot, you know, and I get passionate about it because it is so beyond my comprehension. I don't have anything to sell anybody. I just want to know if you want to be involved, if you want to be engaged. If you want to be engaged, let's jump on a train together and see what happens. Yeah. And that is like what the conversation was about the photography. I'm like, I got ideas on how we talked about things, and Rodney just went and did things, and his life unfolded.
Yeah.
I think people just need to find.
Yeah. It's so, yeah, you dead. Just put it inside. Out there and yeah.
Yes.
And it'll happen. I mean, it's like this gallery that I'm doing now.
I know.
I've been putting it out there for several years now. It's like, I want a gallery, I want a gallery, I want a gallery. And these friends of mine, she called me one day at this little house here in town. She works for
historic stone house. Just yeah, precious.
It's, I know, right?
It's perfect location. And she works for the lady that owns this house, and the previous tenants left. And she said, can you go, you know, start cleaning it up so I can get it back on the market? And she went over there and she called me and she's like, Rodney, you might want to come look at this. I went and looked and I was like, all right, we're starting a gallery.
Yeah.
You know, there's no business plan. There's no, it's just let's go.
Property. Rodney, it's the same thing with your property. Like you've kind of, you know, and here just think about it. Let's just step back and think about when I was there for, remember the wedding? When I was there.
What wedding?
let's pretend that never.
You're married? Did I miss something, Rodney?
Oh, you did. You might have been hiding that thing.
Just once? Oh, you amateur.
Think about us walking down and talking about the school and talking about a place where people come. Now we had the cart before the horse. With a gallery, that's going to be the reason. That's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Like, I literally see that now clearer today, as if we were sitting between those trees and talking about the outdoor kitchen and the things, and here's where the studio is, and this is where we'll have the, like, I can literally see it mm-hmm. with a gallery.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my goodness. Watch out.
Yeah. Watch out. Yeah, hide and watch, as a friend of mine used to say to me. Hide and watch.
Hide and watch. I like that a lot. Actually.
Well, yeah, like I said in the beginning of this, this is going to be have to be a multi-parter with you because
for sure.
We've got so many things and so many stories, and I know that, I mean, I can call you in a week and you're going to be going, oh my God, you're never going to believe what happened to me today.
Yeah.
So
well, and next time I'll jump in there. I got to be a cabaret singer at the age of 50 in New York, you know?
Why not? You know what's so funny, Rodney, is that Passports Please, I am in the first time in my life where my passport has expired. And in the pandemic, I cannot believe. Not only that, my driver's license expired when I got here.
Oh
my God. Like I tried in LA 5 times on the online thing to get it done and nothing. And so I'm in a place where I've never been all of that. Like if something happened and I needed to go out of the country today, I would die.
I didn't even think you could fly domestically with an expired driver's license now.
Well, no, it expired since I got here. So thank God I'm going to be driving.
So can you get home?
So are you driving home?
Yeah, I am driving home.
With an expired driver's license.
I don't recommend that, Corey.
No, it's going to be, that'll be fine.
Remember, he was the one that always got away with stuff. So maybe he's still pushing that narrative.
Exactly. No, it's funny because I did want to drive here initially. Chicago, and the timing just wasn't going to afford it. I had so much to do to get ready to come here that I had to, you know, it didn't work. And my wife surprised me on February 14th, Valentine's Day. She said, happy Valentine's Day. I'm going to drive your car and your dog out in March. And I'm going to stay for a month, and I'm leaving you with the dog in the car, and you're going to be a boy on an American adventure with his dog.
Mm-hmm. What? Come through Austin.
Yeah.
I may do it.
Oh,
I'm going
skip
down
Austin.
To Nashville.
Come to Wimberley.
Yeah. No, I'll go straight to Wimberley. Like, I need to be in one of the cabins. I may actually literally do that. I'm taking my time. The
so
coordination
when is,
of it is
when is this?
June, he said.
It's end of May, first part of June.
Right.
The movie may or may not happen. They have almost got their money in place. If they get the money in place, we'll shoot it, and I'll probably come down there. And
well, you got a car and a dog. You don't need a job. So
that's just, right. Just come on. That's all you need. That's all you need.
Well, Corey, I just want to say, you all were talking about how you can catch up and, you know, not see each other for a year. I call friends like that the, as I was saying, friend. Mm-hmm. That you can be separated for a month, a year, 5 years, and you sit down, and it's like you're saying, well, as I was saying, and the conversation just picks up. Well, I have a feeling that you're going to be my new, as I was saying, friend. So,
oh, please, I would love it, because it is the beautiful thing about these principles of living in a flow.
Mm-hmm.
And the conversation never changes. Like, he and I will be going through such similar things with completely different circumstances, but mm-hmm. what we're going emotionally, mentally, or spiritually, is almost spot on the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a conversation. And to me, that is where I want to live with human beings. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's really hard when you're working. I have a crew of almost 300 people, and I care about every one of them on this mm-hmm. crew, and I'm getting to know all these people, and yet I'm doing all these other things. Like, it's really important to stay human and not just be locked on goals, but be present mm-hmm. to where you are, because we have such an impact on one another.
Mm-hmm.
Every single time. When we're cursed, terse, and rude, or when we're loving, kind, and encouraging. And we get to own all that. You know, it's super important to me.
That sounds like I won't say a note to end on, but a note to put a pause button in until the next time. What a joy and a real treat to get to know you this way. I'm so glad we did the...
Yeah, so...
we're looking at you in person.
Yeah,
so.
Before we wrap it up, tell us where your podcast is living.
Yeah, so we have a podcast site that is called the Unincarcerated Podcast homepage. But we are on literally Spotify. We are on Google. We are on Audible. We're on Stitcher. We're on Deezer. We're on YouTube. Also available through LinkedIn. And there's an Unincarcerated Podcast homepage, unincarceratedthepodcast.com. And all 7 episodes are available there. And we would love to have you follow us on Instagram, Facebook.
Well, we want to thank you again, Corey. What a treat. This has been Rodney. You know, you've hit it out of the ballpark again. I just hang on to Rodney's friends. And I go, oh, yeah, he sounds amazing? Really interesting. And then I go and look at, you know, websites and I look at videos like, oh, he's really interesting. So,
yeah. You had Mary on here already, right? I don't think I've heard it yet.
No, we haven't.
You haven't?
Mm-mm.
Mary Gauthier.
I'm thinking.
Oh, Mary Gauthier. Yeah.
Look that one up, Corey. That was just, we say this about all of our podcasts, but it was just one of our favorites. Yeah.
Well, here's another. Let's just end on one more synchronistic thing. So I meet that woman in Nashville. She knows I'm new to the town and I'm in a recovery situation. And she walks up to me and goes, hey, how you doing? I'm like, hey, I can tell this chick is cool. I had no idea this chick was a chick that everybody knew. She just became my Like, so I'm talking about this person. He goes, are you talking about Mary Gauthier? I'm like, I don't know if that's how you say her last name. It looks here. I spelled it. And he's like, he sends me the picture he's taken of her. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Like, I'm sitting in hanging out with somebody that he shot photos of. That's Rodney's in my relationship.
Yeah.
And every time you're around, you're talking
incredible.
To the same people.
Wow.
You know? Yeah. 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 She's a neat lady. And again, the reality of what's happening in my life, she says, Corey, the longer I walk this path, the further I get from who I thought I was, the closer I get to being where I need to be.
Mm-hmm.
That's the same. She has exactly that same thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. She had a lot to say about that when we had her on. Well, we would be remiss if we didn't also thank our wonderful equipment that was benefited by Rupert Neve Design. And let's just take a moment to honor beautiful Rupert Neve and what he has meant to the world of audio and broadcasting. And he is a Wimberley friend. So it was a loss on so many levels, but we are certainly grateful for the equipment from Rupert Neve Design. We want to thank Jonathan Frankenreiter for our intro and our outro music, our peppy intro and outro music. And then finally, Brock Glenn Thomas, who's our producer and with great grace and regularity gets us out of trouble almost every episode.
On a daily basis.
Oh, and like 2 minutes before this actual broadcast.
Yeah, so, the board shut down and we FaceTimed him and he got it going again.
That's amazing. You know, we had a Neve board on Nashville that was brought in to be set up to be on one of our sets. And I hung out with Rob, the guy that set it up.
That
my friend Rodney knows him and Lizzie Ware. He's like, who's him? It was so funny because I knew what it was when I walked in.
We also want to thank you, our listeners, for joining us in these conversations about the power of place, the places that change us, and why it matters. and to remind you that wonderful adventures of the heart, the mind, and the spirit happen when we say the words or live the words, passports, please. Until next time, thank you.
Don't ever throw away what you could be living. Don't ever give up on what you've been given. Don't wait too long, it's the sunset. Don't get in the way of what you could be getting now. Let's celebrate tonight.